Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
The only way to find out what the true interest is by holding the lease bill. There's nothing lost if nobody shows.
Industry leaders and politicians criticize the Biden administration's cancellation of a Cook Inlet lease sale. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 13th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, a mom in Homer finally has some answers about her daughter who went missing in 2019.
After 2.5 years with your daughter being missing and having not a clue where she is, my mind was quite active.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
People who smoke or have smoking-related conditions like lung and heart disease are more likely to get seriously ill from COVID-19. Not using any tobacco or e-cigarette products is one of the best ways to keep your immune system strong, ready to fight all kinds of viruses. If you decide to quit, help is available. Call Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or text READY to 200-400 to get the support you need to quit for good. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line.
The federal government won't auction off tracts for oil and gas drilling in Cook Inlet this year. The Department of the Interior announced this week it is canceling a pending auction for up to 1 million acres of leases, capping a tumultuous timeline of stopping and starting for the proposed plan. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more on how Alaskans are reacting.
In an emailed statement, Interior Department spokesperson Melissa Schwartz says the cancellation's due to a lack of interest from the industry. Kara Moriarty finds that logic baffling. She's president of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, and she says companies don't usually let on as to whether they'll participate in a sale or not. She says she doesn't even know.
Participating in lease sales is a highly guarded secret, if you will, because companies don't want to tip their hand to their competition that they might be interested in an area.
She says any lack of comments to the department from oil and gas companies doesn't necessarily signal a lack of interest.
The only way to find out what the true interest is by holding the lease bill. There's nothing lost if nobody shows. And that's happened in the past.
Opponents of the now canceled sale, on the other hand, did get out thousands of comments submitted to the feds. Over 90,000, says Liz Mehring. She's advocacy director for local nonprofit Cook Inlet Keeper, which has led a fervent campaign against the sale, including an art sale to raise money and awareness for efforts last year. And Mehring says those efforts have paid off.
First, it's an amazing feeling. It's just so nice to have a win, and to remind people that everybody's actions and everybody commenting and taking time out of their day to testify or to do all of the things that our community does to advocate for, you know, the future we want in Cook Inlet do really matter.
She says the cited lack of industry interest doesn't really come as a surprise. The feds canceled Cook Inlet lease sales for the same reason in 2006, 2008, and then again in 2010.
However, we also hope that the industry as well is looking at the strong local opposition and the serious concerns and the fact that people aren't going to be quiet. And so at the same time, also thinking that could have certainly playing a role as well.
The Biden administration hit pause on this lease sale in early 2021, part of a broader order geared at combating climate change. The process resumed following a lawsuit from Alaska and several other states, though the federal government's always able to cancel lease sales, even once environmental impact statements are already filed. Bigger picture, Mehring says she hopes for more permanent rejections of oil and gas in Cook Inlet. The order doesn't necessarily cancel all lease sales in the inlet, just this one. She also says it's important to note that the sale wouldn't have impacted gas prices for years to come. Alaska politicians, including Governor Mike Dunleavy and U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan, have said on social media the move shows a disregard for the high gasoline prices consumers are currently paying at the pump. Moriarty, with the industry group, says the decision sends a message that the Biden administration isn't interested in oil and gas development coming from American sources. The department also announced it's not holding 2 lease sales in the Gulf of Mexico.
So it just doesn't make sense as to why you wouldn't want your future oil and gas for energy security as well as for Alaska, for Alaskan consumers, especially when we're talking about Cook Inlet, to come from America.
And she says without federal leases, the industry will turn the focus to state ones in Cook Inlet. The state of Alaska auctioned off 3.3 million acres of oil and gas leases in Cook Inlet last June, resulting in 8 successful bids from 2 different companies. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
A former Chief Justice of the Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska has been appointed to the Not Invisible Act Commission. U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced the commission last week and said it will be tasked with helping improve how the government addresses a decades-long crisis of missing and murdered Native Americans and Alaska Natives. KTOO's Yvonne Crumry has more.
Michelle Jekathot Demert has served in many roles in her time as a lawyer and a judge, but she knows that this next role will have its own challenges.
This is not an easy commission to be part of. We will have to take testimony. We will have to hear stories.
She thinks hearing these testimonies from victims' families will make her eager to see change enacted quickly, maybe more quickly than possible.
And of course, you know, as a problem solver, what I want to do is help find solutions. And I may not be able to immediately respond in that way.
She also says that she expects she will need support from elders, which is a role that the commission lacks right now.
Missing from the commission, I think, is a named tribal elder who, you know, who could really hold space for us and send us off in a good way and also, you know, just help us because this is going to be really hard.
The Not Invisible Act Commission meets for the first time in 2 weeks. Demert says they plan to start broadly in their look at communities impacted by high rates of missing and murdered Indigenous people.
Why do we have this crisis? And of course, it's not an easy why to answer because it's a historical factor. And so we have to acknowledge the issues that led us to this situation.
From there, the commission plans to use this research to shape policies and improve communication between tribal, state, and federal resources. The commission is 37 members that include tribal leaders, survivors, and families of those who've been missing and murdered, as well as law enforcement. According to the Department of Justice, the commission was created to, quote, combat the epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous people. Tamara Drew of the Alaska Native Women's Resource Center and Vivian Cortuhiz, the CEO of the Association of Village Council Presidents, are also on the commission. Secretary of the Interior Deb Haaland announced the commission on May 5th, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Peoples Awareness Day. In Juneau, I'm Yvonne Crumry.
The director of the Office of Equal Opportunity in Anchorage has been fired. Heather McAlpine had served in her role for nearly 7 years. McAlpine says that she got a letter Tuesday afternoon informing her that as an executive appointment, she serves at the pleasure of the mayor and that her services were no longer needed.
I did not voluntarily resign, nor do I know why my services were no longer of use to the municipality. So I'm a little perplexed.
In her role, McAlpine says she worked on projects like ensuring federal grants are given equitably to minority and women-owned businesses. She also says her office was a place where city employees could come to report discrimination and harassment. Some assembly members are concerned about the firing and the lack of explanation. Austin Quinn Davidson represents West Anchorage and previously served as acting mayor.
Heather plays an important role at the municipality, and I'm not only concerned about her getting fired, but about the many other muni employees that have either gotten fired over the last however many months it's been, or left.
The Bronson administration did not respond to questions about McAlpine's departure as of Friday afternoon. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a ghost barge is free-floating down the Kuskokwim River after it froze into the river last fall.
It'll go drown somewhere, probably even before, the Pakiak could be my guess, somewhere down there.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Annie Wright Schools, located in Tacoma, Washington, offers rich, thoughtful, and internationally recognized programs for students from around the world. A variety of boarding options are available year-round. There's a virtual preview of the school, the faculty, and campus for high school students seeking to explore international baccalaureate academics, arts, and athletics at aw.org/Alaska. This message sponsored by Annie Wright Schools.
A reality TV star is facing charges for illegally killing a black bear in Kenai Fjords National Park. Blaine Anthony is the star of Bear Whisperer, a weekly documentary-style show focused on bear hunting and conservation started in 2011. According to charges filed May 6th, originally obtained and reported by the Daily Beast, Anthony shot a black bear in Pilot Harbor in 2017, lied about where he shot it, and then sent the bear to Maine to be taxidermied. The hunt was later featured on his show. Hunting is not allowed in the national park, and federal prosecutors say Anthony and his production company violated the Lacey Act, which bans the trafficking of wildlife and plants that are taken illegally. The charges say Anthony, a resident of Maine, took at least 8 black bear hunting trips to the Kenai Peninsula between 2011 and 2019. They say he featured 2 illegal black bear kills from within Kenai Fjords on his show. Anthony also violated the Lacey Act when he lied about the May 2017 bear kill on paperwork filed with the state, according to the charges. Feds say the hunter wrote that he shot the bear in Burger Bay, a legal hunting site outside the park, about 20 miles away from Pilot Harbor. But in reality, they say he took the bear in Pilot Harbor with an Alaska-based guide and transported it back to Homer, then to Maine. Anthony could not be reached for comment before airtime. A photo dated May 15, 2017 on Anthony's personal Instagram shows him sitting over what he says is a 400-pound black bear tagged in Homer. Anthony will face a court hearing on the charges on June 10th. Two and a half years after Homer resident Anisha Duffy Murnane's unexplained disappearance, her friends and family finally got some answers this week that police had arrested a man for allegedly abducting and killing her. 32-year-old Kirby Calderwood faces charges of kidnapping, murder, and evidence tampering. Murnane's mother, Sarah Berg, says the news has been bittersweet. Berg says she's glad to know what happened to her daughter and to have a chance at getting justice, but she says what happened was horrific, and now Berg is trying to hold off cancer long enough to see Calderwood taken to trial.
Every day is a unique experience. I never know between the cancer and the agony of the loss, how I'm going to be, how you're going to wake up, you don't know. And some days are cry all day days, and other days I'm in the kitchen, I'm singing, I'm okay. And then the thought hits you, and you're down crying again. But some days it's pretty good all day, but you never know. It's like a guessing game. It's like you don't have control.
That sounds terrible. It sounds like you're fighting cancer, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And I was in full remission when Duffy got taken. I was on no medicines at all. I was down in Mexico. I was feeling pretty darn good. Everything was great. Duffy was going to join me down there. And then she was taken and the cancer just went off like a rocket.
Yeah. I'm sorry for bringing this all up again, and I appreciate you talking to me. And it sounds like in just this recent news that we've heard about her case that there was a lot of police work going on behind the scenes that members of the public didn't know about. But did you have much of a sense of what was going on?
We had a lot of hints. We knew that that tip had come in last May. We didn't know it was a tip. We just knew that our detective was working very, very hard for very many months. And that he's a man of few words and a lot of action. And then early April, we started getting phone calls asking questions here and there, just little questions. So I was not totally shocked when they came to the door on Mother's Day evening to tell us, because he knew it was going to hit the fan the next day and he wanted us to be prepped. And the minute we saw them at the door, we knew that something horrendous had happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did they say? I mean, in that kind of that initial explanation of what?
Hardly anything. They just basically told me that they had apprehended somebody. They were in Utah. That they gave us his name, They said that he had been a caregiver for my daughter at the Maintree supported living. I had never met him, and I was there all the time. He must have been a part-time worker. I had never met him. And he told me not to read any papers or listen to much that was going on. And that's all he said, pretty much. He kind of kept it basic. I asked him, how was she killed? He said, I'd rather not say. And he said he'd be in touch, which he has been. He's called us every day since then. But no, it was the next day that, you know, I read the paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Which, you know, he told me not to read the paper, but I thought, I don't want to hear about this for the first time in the courtroom, or I don't want some idiot coming up and saying something to me. And so I read it all, but, you know, after 2.5 years with your daughter being missing and having not a clue where she is, my mind was quite active, and I felt very strongly that she was not killed until the beginning of December. And I just said, and I thought she was being held and tortured all that time. So one day is a lot different than that. But it still was absolutely horrendous. It was horrendous to hear what he had done to her.
Yeah.
She was the sweetest girl that ever lived. She was so kind and sweet. Yeah. So I just want him gone from society forever. I don't want any other mother to ever suffer like this. And I certainly don't want any girl to go through what my daughter went through. So I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that this all happens. You know, they say it might be 2 years till the trial. And by gum, I'm going to stay alive for the 2 years, and I'm going to be there at that trial.
That was Sarah Berg, the mother of Anisha Duffy Murnane, who disappeared from Homer in 2019. Police have arrested 32-year-old Kirby Calderwood in her murder.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Air Cargo, serving the commerce and business needs of 20 Alaska communities, from Adak to Barrow to Ketchikan. More information at alaskacargo.com. Alaska's unique approach to mental health funding is improving the lives of Alaskans who experience behavioral health conditions and developmental disabilities. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority has a responsibility to generate revenue from its 1 million acres of land and the resources they contain. The trust uses this revenue to help fund statewide programs and initiatives that positively impact trust beneficiaries. To learn more, visit alaskamentalhealthtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
The Iditarod Trail Committee has partially reversed its decision to penalize two mushers who sheltered their dog teams in a cabin during a severe windstorm during this year's 1,000-mile race. The decision announced Thursday comes after the two mushers, Mile Porsild and Michelle Phillips, appealed their penalty. Porsild and Phillips were the top female finishers in this year's race. On one of their final runs to the finish between Koyuk and Elim, they hit a severe windstorm and said they had to move their dog teams inside a cabin to protect them. That is against the Iditarod's rules, and some competitors filed formal complaints, saying it may have given the mushers a competitive advantage. The Iditarod organization moved the mushers back in the standings shortly after the race finished, which cost them hundreds of dollars in prize money. But that decision was reversed in Thursday's ruling, meaning that Porsild will be awarded nearly $3,500 more in prize money for finishing in 14th. Phillips will get an extra $1,000 and finish in 17th. However, both mushers must pay a $1,000 fine. That's equivalent to the fine a third musher, Riley Dyke, got for sheltering his dogs in a cabin on his final run to Nome. The Iditarod Trail Committee wrote in a statement that the board respects the judgment call made by the two mushers,
It said no dogs should suffer harm or death during the race and recommended a race committee review the rules that prohibit sheltering dogs indoors. Last fall, Alaska Logistics left two barges to freeze in YK Delta rivers. One barge has dislodged and become a free-floating ghost barge winding down the Kuskokwim River. It's been stuck at the Machivik Slough just below Tuluksak since Tuesday. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports.
The ghost barge has a name. It's called the Lily. It traveled about 170 river miles down the Kuskokwim after dislodging from the ice when the river broke up at Georgetown on Sunday. Alaska Logistics owns the barge and left it to freeze in place last fall when an early cold snap sealed its wintry fate.
Just, I don't know, it kind of caught us.
That's Ellen Long, a co-owner and manager of Alaska Logistics. Long said he made the decision to let the Lily freeze into the river when ice started to form around it in October, and its accompanying tugboat experienced motor issues. But he did take a couple of measures to secure it for breakup. His crew tried to brace the barge against a sandbar. Then they fastened the loader that it was carrying to its top. And third, they pumped it full of water to try to weigh it down to prevent it from capsizing.
We pumped about 15 or 20,000 gallons of water into it.
But despite their efforts, the barge got loose and the loader on top moved. Willie Phillips from Tuluksak saw it more than 150 miles into its journey. He took a boat out for logging and spotted it on Tuesday as it was passing the village.
Seems like it shifted a little bit forward. The front area was lower than the back.
It moved past the village and lodged itself into a sandbar at Machivik Slough. Other villagers along the Kuskokwim have been checking on it. Someone in Akiak traveled up the river to take photos of the Lily and posted them to Facebook. Long, the Alaska Logistics manager, chuckles when he thinks about the barge entertaining Kuskokwim residents. He's not concerned about the barge drifting too far or floating to sea.
The likelihood of it getting out the mouth is very, very, very small. It'll go aground somewhere probably even before, Napakiak would be my guess, somewhere down there, somewhere probably around Oscarville.
Long says it's not safe to go after the barge until the ice is all cleared up from the river. Ice is jammed on the Kuskokwim at Bethel. But once it's safe, Long says it should be easy to get the barge back.
We have our own tugboats and different friends that would help us find it. People kind of on standby and fishing boats.
The Lily wasn't the only Alaska Logistics barge to freeze into YK Delta rivers last fall. Another barge froze near Eek. But they anchored that one and it stayed in place. In 2019, Alaska Logistics had another barge freeze in place and then free float down the Kuskokwim during spring breakup. That one traveled from Aniak to Bethel. Long says his company has been moving freight by barge in the region for 20 years. He blames climate change for making freeze-ups and breakups, quote, more dramatic. When Long left the barges to freeze into the rivers in the fall, the Coast Guard told KYUK they were planning to do an investigation to see if there was any wrongdoing on the part of Alaska Logistics. The Coast Guard did not return phone calls on Thursday. In Bethel, I'm Olivia Eberts.
Ulacon, the small smelt fish known in Lingit as sock, has returned to the Upper Lynn Canal, marking a celebration of spring. The nutrient-rich fish is essential for subsistence culture and marine life. As KHNS's Corinne Smith reports, a long-term research study is tracking the fish's populations across southeast Alaska to better understand and protect the species.
Meredith Pokar walks across the mudflats at the mouth of the Chilkoot River, headed to the water. There are some signs of spring, with shorebirds circling and the sun warming through a light layer of fog. But the Ulacon run, known as sock and clinket, candlefish, or hooligan, are largely missing.
Yeah, it's a little disconcerting that this is the second year in a row that we haven't seen a run materialize on the Chilkoot River. We saw, a few days ago, we saw a small school of fish move in, and there's a lot of activity, and it looked like, you know, there's going to be a bunch more fish that came behind them, and we just didn't see them.
Pokart is here every day before and during the spring run from mid-April to mid-May. She's the lead researcher with the Chilkoot Indian Association's regional monitoring project for the fish population. The first telltale sign of the spring run is the sound of the gulls and seabirds overhead and the seals and sea lions and sometimes orcas in the water. Another method is gathering DNA.
There's currently no fish in the Chilkoot River, but we'll still take samples and see if, you know, maybe some came in last night and spawned, or maybe there's some DNA around that we can still pick up from the samples.
Cocard fills two large bottles with water from the estuary. Those samples will go to a lab in Oregon to analyze the environmental DNA, engage fish populations, ecology, and distribution. The research project launched in 2010 after an alert went out along the West Coast that the Ulacan populations were in steep decline. They were labeled endangered in the waters off of Washington, Oregon, and California. It's not only a spring food source for Tlingit communities, but also important for medicinal, cultural, and social well-being. Longtime Haines resident Philip Jackson described what the spring harvest was like on the Chilkoot River when he was growing up on a recent morning with KHNS's History Talk.
And there'd be singing and dancing, you know, and it was always so much fun, you know, and hearing the elders talking in Tlingit and telling jokes and giggling and laughing was the utmost for me.
No Ulacan in the Chilkoot River isn't necessarily a bad sign. When and where the small smelt fish run from year to year can vary quite a bit. Pocard says there is a run in the Chilkoot River this year. Dozens of residents were out with nets over the weekend harvesting Ulacan for oil and smoking. A spring run was spotted in Skagway too. Reuben Cash is the environmental coordinator with the Skagway Traditional Council.
Starting on May 1st, we went from a couple of hundred of gulls down at the Tyre River in Dyea to several thousand. We saw sea lions coming, cruising up the inlet, heading that way. I guess there was a humpback whale in the inlet. So lots of activity.
Cash is also collecting water samples for DNA analysis in the Tyre and Skagway rivers as part of the regional initiative. He says the cruise ship season may also have impacted the runs.
They have an aversion to noise. They really don't like loud things. We've seen that in some other rivers around southeast when there's a lot of noise activity. The fish will just switch rivers. So they may have just turned around altogether up here. It's hard to say until we see numbers come back from the lab.
Results from the DNA sampling will help tell the story later this summer. Haines-based researcher Meredith Pocart will be analyzing results from the area rivers and the Unik River near Ketchikan and comparing observations with communities in British Columbia. And hopefully this year, they'll have a better understanding of this important fish species. In Haines, I'm Corinne Smith.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Yvonne Crumrie in Juneau, Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Olivia Eberts in Bethel, and Corinne Smith in Haines. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby. Annie Fite produced tonight's show, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Princess Lodges, offering glass-domed railcar tours to Talkeetna and Denali National Park for Alaska summer adventures. Your journey begins at princesslodges.com.
And by
Alaska Air Cargo, providing Gold Streak Express shipping for urgent deliveries throughout Alaska, with connections to more than 100 destinations in the lower 48 and Hawaii. More at alaskacargo.com.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.